I'm very happy now to welcome Duke Phillips. He's CEO of Ranchlands. He's manager of the Nature Conservancy Medano Zapata Ranch in Southern Colorado. He is on the board of the Western Landowners Alliance, and we are talking to him here outside of El Hermoso. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here.
So you have a really interesting background as a rancher. You grew up in Venezuela and in northern Mexico. You studied classical literature. Tell us a little bit about your early days.
Well, my dad was a old-style rancher who the psychiatrist called him a rugged individualist. So he always wanted to go in the part of the world where you could ranch in isolated places away from the rest of the world in a way that, you know, was 100 years back. So I was raised on a ranch in northern Mexico that was about 150 miles from the border, 5 hours from town. So there was a community of people there who really were 100 years behind times. And so we had babies that were born and died on the ranch. We had our own commissary. It was a horse culture. There were no trucks. It was all wagons. People would make paint brushes out of yucca plants. They used medicinal plants. They knew what all the plants were for. So it was really, really blessed to have been brought up in that kind of environment. You know, that was so different than anything you can find today. It's hard to find.
Your dad was American?
Yeah, he was Texan. He was from San Antonio.
So you grew up there, and then they didn't want you to go straight into the family business.
Well, I grew up there, and I was homeschooled to eighth grade, but then there wasn't any more, so I had to leave, and I went to Dallas to high school at an independent school, and then took off and studied creative writing for college, and spent my 20s basically traveling, and I worked for a year in Australia in a 3-million-acre place just because I wanted to see what it was like, you know, to go back to where there was no fences, where people lived on the land. So I basically, my dad said, don't study ranching, study from people who are doing cool stuff and go out and have fun while you can. And so that's what I did.
So when you were in Africa, you studied with the famous Alan Savory, who came up with a way of ranching that in ways, certain ways mimicked ecosystems as they originally evolved.
Well, actually, I was doing other things in Africa, but in the early 80s, I was fortunate enough to go to his second school he had in the States, and he was a guy that spent his postgraduate years as a hunter who controlled wild animals, and he was able to see how nature worked before we came upon the scene. And so he came up with this theory or this idea of how to emulate the way bison or any ungulates used to graze back in huge herds and then move and following the clouds and the rain and the sun and then laying all the organic material on the ground that they didn't eat, defecating, urinating, recycling, you know, protecting the ground for the water cycle, and so seedlings could come up and all these different things that happened. So as ranchers implementing his ideas, instead of taking cattle and putting them across your land, you put them all into one big mob and then move them in a migratory fashion around your ranch, trying to emulate the way bison used to do it.
And that worked really well. I mean, did you try it yourself?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's all I've been doing ever since then, or you know, working with people who had done that.
So did you grow up with the values of wildlife conservation and water and land conservation that you have now?
Well, I think my formative years were, I mean, what that gave me was a sense of what land looked like that was as pristine as it could be. So I grew up in a place where maybe one or two dozen people had been to before. So I had this appreciation of living in wild land with people who were completely in tune with that. So I had that value that I brought with me, and then meeting Alan Savory also was someone who had been formed by what he experienced in the wild land in a whole different part of the world, and the connections he made between, you know, ecology and the needs of wildlife, the needs of people, and so forth, which it came to me at a time that greatly influenced me as a young ranch manager coming into the world and starting to think about, okay, how am I going to do this?
So how does, in your experience, caring about conservation, caring about wildlife, about native plants and so on, help a ranch? How does it help it in terms of its health, in terms of its economics?
Well, a lot of people say, well, you know, how did you become an environmentalist or a conservationist, or why, you know, why did, has it become so important to you, and why are you different? And I always say, it's important to all ranchers. There's this antagonistic relationship between environmentalism and ranchers that has pitted them against each other, and a perception about ranchers who don't care, or they're mining the land or whatever. And sure, that's happened. I mean, I'm not saying it hasn't, and there's been some bad things historically happened. But if you were to go to a ranch, 90% of the time, you're going to find someone who cares deeply about the land, and they may not be able to do the best job, but most times it's because there's an economic problem. And so if you're unable to meet the note at the bank, and then you go into a drought, or the market goes south, whatever happens, if you don't have another source of income, you don't have diversified business-wise, well, then you have to keep the cattle on the land. So if there's a problem, it's usually due to an economic problem or something like that. So the natural resources that are under the management of a rancher are exceedingly important because they're going to sustain the animals, and the animals are going to sustain their family, and their family obviously cares about their kids and future and so on and so forth. So if you can maintain a natural environment that's conducive to your business, which is grazing cattle, well, then it makes sense. I mean, it's not rocket science.
So maintaining a natural environment that's conducive to your business, namely raising cattle, what does that look like in terms of, say, you know, wildlife and wetlands and things like that?
Well, there's a really important distinction I want to make between managing for production versus managing for a whole system, because they're the same thing. I mean, not really, but if you're going to have a production model, it may mean you're going to mine it, you're going to take from it without building it. But if you're managing for a system that's whole, self-sustaining, natural, well, then you're going to be automatically meeting the needs. You're going to preserve water, your mineral cycle, your energy cycle. All those things are going to be as efficient as possible, which means there's more to eat, which is what you ultimately need if you have cows who need to grow.
So if you're managing for the land, you're managing essentially for the ecosystem.
Right.
There's going to be more for the cows to eat, which means eventually your production is going to be stronger, ironically, than if you were managing strictly for production.
Right, and the wildlife and microorganisms and everything else is going to profit as well.
We're talking to Duke Phillips. This ranch is a nature conservancy, basically reserve, and it's a working ranch that is profitable. How did this project come together?
Well, my dad, a long time ago, pointed to a really small article, and he said, here's a group that puts their money where their mouth is. You know, they don't go around telling people what to do, but they actually believe in something, and then they take that belief, and they buy a piece of land and try to make it happen. And so they had bought this ranch, and there was a lot of different reasons. But one of the problems that many landowners have, not just the Nature Conservancy, but many absentee owners, people who make their living in a different industry and they come in and buy a ranch, is that they underestimate what it takes to actually economically sustain a ranch. And then when that happens, within the environmental or conservation values also fall behind. So the Nature Conservancy was having issues with the actual on-the-ground management. And so that's what brought us together, really, is I approached them. I said, let's get together so that you can do what you do well, and so we can do what we do well, and we'll do something that is better together than what we did separately from each other. So, you know, I'm a professional rancher, and I know how to take the ideas that are floating out there that related to conservation, preserving water, whatever, and actually take those and actually make them happen on the ground. And that's what I do. And that's what ranchers do.
So you've been doing this here for 10 years. What are some of the things you've done? How's the ranch different from the way it was when you got here?
Well, we cut costs greatly, and everything that we did was very simple, basic. You know, we turned the heat off the winter, so the big barns aren't being... And really, I think it's more about getting people who understand what needs to be done every day on a ranch and who are inspired by being successful and being part of something that is going to save the world, as opposed to just going out and feeding cows.
How's it going to save the world?
In a lot of ways. Ranching is a truly American way of life. We didn't bring that across the ocean like we did Christmas or Easter. That's us. That's who we are. And so if we can preserve a way of life, a basic pillar that our culture was based on, I see that as being very valuable and something that I want to pass on to my kids. I think ranchers are one of the best solutions that we have available today in large-scale preservation, because we're living out there, and what happens affects us directly. Our ancestors have been there a long time, so our roots are very deep, and we're already living there. And so if we can be open to new technology, new science, partnering with non-traditional partners like the Nature Conservancy, Rocky Mountain Bird Observatory, Kavira Coalition, all these great organizations who want exactly the same thing we do. The problem is that we always talk about what we don't agree on. That's what creates friction and antagonism between us. So if we can talk about how we want clean air, we want clean water, we want water we can drink, we want our children to be able to go to school they want to, we want our wives and husbands to do what they want to do, well then all of a sudden we're working together. So that's how we're going to save the world.
How did you come to have bison on this ranch rather than cows?
The bison were here, and they had been here before the Nature Conservancy bought it, and so they just happened to be part of the package.
And they are now part of the economy of this ranch.
Yeah.
How does that work, and how is it different from raising cows? How is it similar?
Well, in 2004, we arrived here, and I had actually never even seen a buffalo except in a zoo or in a photo. And the herd that we have here is a conservation herd, meaning that we're trying to duplicate how they acted in nature, 100 years ago. They are very regal. They have this presence, and you just look at them and you go, this is a creature that came through the eons, and it can't help but move you. There's a lot of misconceptions about buffalo. People think that they're going to come kill you if you get out of your car. They're going to tear fences up. They think that they're wild and mean, but they're actually not. They're very, very private, I guess is, one word to use. They're very, you can walk up to them, you can drive up, ride up to them on a horse, and they're curious, and they kind of just hang out. And when they walk, they have this amazing way of walking, just so slow. And then they can be so fast, athletic, physical. Cattle have been designed by humans. They've taken some form of what they used to be. It might have been a bison, maybe, whatever it was. And it's been evolved into an animal that can be herded, can be trained more easily, and it can be yield a higher ratio of meat to bone than a buffalo. And they can be much meaner and tougher to handle.
Cows.
Cows can.
But for the bison, you need these, very high metal fences?
Yeah. Well, see, they act like a school of fish. Like if you have some buffalo that run into an alley, let's say 20 foot wide, that's 100 foot long, if they run in one end, the lead animal will hit the gate and everything else will just kind of go over the top of them, and you'll end up with this big ball of animals. Cattle will run in, but they're not so herd bound. If you're running along and trying to herd them and there's a gap between two horsemen, the animal that sees that gap turns and the entire herd will turn at the same time, even the ones in front who can't see actually what that one buffalo saw. So it's just like a school of minnows, or you've seen in National Geographic ocean shots where you have this amazing school of fish that just move as if they're one organism. They do the same thing.
So they signal each other and they move as a herd.
It's not a, you know, it's not a physical thing. I don't think it's like there's this invisible string or invisible vibe, electrical current. I don't know what it is.
You've got two herds. One of them you're trying to replicate the kind of original state of the buffalo and study that.
Mm-hmm.
What's the economic component of that? And then tell us about the other herd.
Well, we don't really know. I mean, there's... You know, what is the value of trying to understand the wildness of something? I mean, everybody has ideas. I have my ideas. But there's something interesting about that concept.
Yeah.
So that's what we're doing.
So that's it's really more a scientific
yeah.
part than the business.
Right. I mean, business-wise, we wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
And the reason is because you have a male-to-female ratio of that's one-to-one as close as possible. And when you're trying to, an economic model is having more females.
An economic model is having more females because they reproduce.
And you make your money off of the progeny.
Right.
So the more females, the more progeny. It only takes one bull for 25 cows if you're just breeding for breeding purposes.
So the herd that is really more for understanding wildness, are you working with scientists? Are you working with researchers?
We're working with the Nature Conservancy. It's their project. I'm managing it for them. We're working with USGS. And there's other groups in the, across the country, not many of them, that are interested in the same thing. So we're kind of working together. The other herd is a young herd that we have trained to electric fence, to horses, to eating a supplement, to dogs, to horses, so that we can actually move them in a very focused way using electric fence in a migratory fashion that we do with cattle. So you're trying to duplicate how bison used to move before we even came into the American West, which was basically there were big herds that protected themselves by joining together and pushing the weak and the old at the outside, the young to the inside. But because the herds were so immense, I mean, trains would stop for 9 days for one herd to go by.
What?
Yeah, 9 days. Historical, documented. So obviously they run out of food pretty quick, and so they leave, and a herd that immense, you can imagine what they do to the land. I mean, it's like a tractor or something, go over it, manure, urine. Everything that grew up was laying on the ground covering, just like a gardener manages his gardener. You cover the soil to keep the sun from drying it out, seedlings to propagate, conserve water, and to change organic material into soil. And so you have a symbiotic relationship between the Great Plains or any grasslands and these great ungulates. You've seen pictures of wildebeest in Africa, right? Just going, you know, everywhere, covering the landscape. So what we're trying to do with this other herd of buffalo is to do that same thing by using fences to move them rather than fences being the thing that stops them from moving.
And so you're moving them in herds and...
One herd.
In a herd, and they... and then you rest the land that they were on, then rests after they go to the next pasture, that kind of thing?
Well, we basically move... The speed at which we move is determined by growth rates. So when you leave a pasture, you're monitoring that plant, and you not come back to it until it's completely recovered. And you're trying to get soil litter on the ground. You're trying to improve the water cycle, mineral cycle, energy flow, all these things.
Now, these herds of buffalo that were so immense that they took 9 days to cross the railroad, and you said they moved in these herds to protect themselves. Who were they protecting themselves against?
Wolves, Indians, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just... a family unit that had uncles and aunts and then the generations of young ones intermingled. So you have a big group. The old would get left behind or get pushed to the outside or the weak or crippled or whatever, and the young ones would be protected by the group, you know, by the structure of a herd.
We're talking to rancher Duke Phillips. One of the things that you've talked about is the importance of economic diversification on a ranch. How does, first of all, what does that look like, and how does it help the conservation project?
Well, traditionally, ranchers produce beef as a single business, and they may have a horse business or, you know, sell horses or may have a little bit of hunting or something. So traditionally, it's pretty much one thing that ranchers do. We look at land as a multidimensional resource to try to figure out, you know, what kinds of things does the land have. You know, every piece of land is unique and has an amenity that's intrinsic to it. It could be a river, it could be a lake, could be proximity to a ski resort, hunting, whatever. And every person has something they like doing, something they're good at. So what we try to do is create businesses around those two concepts. And so we have a recreation business that invites people to come out to the ranch to learn about ranching and the role ranching plays in the conservation, large-scale conservation. Enjoy nature, learn about nature. We have a leather shop that makes products, leather products.
From the bison?
Bison or cattle herd. When we have another ranch that's all cattle. It's about the same size. We have art gatherings where we ask artists to come to the ranch and paint or do photography, and then we take that body of work and have an exhibit and sell that art. We have concerts. Steve Earle was at the ranch last summer. And so we try to do all these different things to produce income so that if we get into a drought like we have been through the last 4 years, then we can destock because the production's not there. You know, there's no water, so we can do that sooner as opposed to later, in the interest of the land being able to, you know, get through this depression and moisture.
So then, basically, when there's a drought, you can sell the cattle or bison. If they're going to be too many for the amount of land
right.
that you have, and then conserve the land, and then you've got these other income streams.
Mm-hmm. It's a really important, I think, a very critical component to conservation today.
Are a lot of ranchers using that kind of model?
I think it's more and more so. Mm-hmm.
What wildlife do you have on the ranch besides, I mean, I guess, I don't know if you call bison, I guess they're more livestock than wildlife. But anyway, what other kinds of wildlife do you have?
Well, there's an amazing number of birds. We have over 330 birds on our bird list, and a lot of those are migratory birds. But we have coyotes, badger, a bobcat, elk, mule deer, whitetail, prairie dogs, gophers.
And have you seen a difference in the number of these creatures since you've taken over the ranch?
The things that, I mean, everybody asks that question, and no, we don't see a big difference because the change is going to, it happened very fast, but the degradation, but the getting it back to where it was is going to take a long time. The only place that we do see it is where there's water. So because of water, you know, you have a lot faster growth rates. So we're seeing a huge change in riparian areas. So where we once came and I'm not talking about just this ranch, but other ranches that we manage, you'll have a small ribbon of water because the livestock or whatever has been left in, and they just go to the riparian areas because that's where the water is, that's where the green grass is. And by managing the grazing so that so you have short grazing exposures and then they get off and it grows back, we've been able to create riparian areas that are very healthy. You know, they have these huge areas of cattails, reeds, the birds. Everything's changes like a sponge. All of a sudden, the land starts soaking up the water, and it gets wide and wider and wider and wider.
Which probably makes the land more, for lack of a better word, attractive or beautiful to visitors who are maybe urban people who are coming mm-hmm. to visit, which is part of the economics of your ranch.
Sure. No, it's really beautiful, and it also makes the land more valuable from an investor standpoint.
From an investor standpoint, but it's under a kind of conservation status to where it wouldn't, I mean, you wouldn't sell it.
No, I'm just talking about in general. If you're looking across the Western United States, large landscapes, one of the principal things that is happening is that people are buying and selling land. And so the goal is that how are we going to pay for conservation? How are we going to pay for buying land to conserve it? And so the values that you can create, economic value you can create and build into management to try to increase the value of land are extremely important, simply because then you get a support base and you're not out there trying to, you know, etch a living from a cow or whatever. So a conservation group, for example, will go to their constituent and say, we are doing this to this land and it's increasing and this, therefore it's worth more money, therefore people are going to come support what we're doing.
Right. So how do you teach what you know? Are other ranchers coming to you and saying, hey, I want to do what you're doing?
Yeah, to some degree. We have over 2,000 kids that come to our programs annually. We have workshops for grazing planning, financial planning, roping, herding, all these kinds of things. And so they're all mediums for us to get people together to exchange ideas and talk about all these things.
We're talking to rancher Duke Phillips of the Zapata Ranch and the Western Landowners Alliance. Now, you said a little while ago something which I think is very interesting and important, which is ranching is a very American thing. It's American way of life. You are from a multi-generation ranching family, and preserving ranching is a really important way of preserving the West, preserving the land. At the same time, I mean, there has been a lot of damage done by ranching, by overgrazing, and some of the things you're talking about are real changes in that tradition. So what's changing? What's staying the same?
Well, I think that there's a lot more pressure from the greater, I call it the greater society or the bigger society, and 98% of our population is non-ranchers. Ranchers are 2%, so with the environmental worries and problems that we're having across the world, the globe, there's a very, you know, I call it a kind of an environmental awakening that's happening. And so people are looking down, you know, over our shoulders and saying, okay, what are you doing? Where before you didn't have that. So that's a big change. And so conservation today, even though it's always been important to ranchers as a resource, is a product just like beef is. So,
what do you mean?
We produce conservation just like we produce beef. So there is a value in today's world because of the concern that people have over the treatment of the environment that puts a price or a value on proper management. So if you're able to manage your land and produce carbon or carbon sequestration or whatever it is, and those markets haven't emerged yet, and they're coming. But riparian restoration, or if you have any kind of restorative kind of program, there is a value that people recognize and are willing to. And that could be by people coming to bird on your ranch because you are a respected manager and they want to support you. There's a value in that.
Yeah, I mean, there's a value in it, and I think society is just coming to really recognize that value, the value of watersheds, the value of clean land that's filtering the water, for example, the value of pollinators.
Right. All those things that are becoming into our consciousness and that wasn't there before.
Right. And there's a kind of funny thing. It's like we Americans want to put a dollar value on everything, and that's kind of a double-edged sword. I mean, some things are valuable just because they are life-giving, not because they're worth money. It turns out these things are also worth money.
Yeah, they are. It's a money component, but there's also more of a what you might call an intrinsic value. So land, in order to continue the way it always has been, needs help, and that's worth something. You know, that has a value. It doesn't mean it's a capitalistic thing. It's just important.
I think it's also, I think one of the other things that's changing, and I'd love your perspective on this, but that's changing in society is this question of, are we conserving land because that makes it more valuable for us and those species are part of the ecosystem, and if we have a healthy ecosystem, then we're healthy. But then there's another way of looking at it, which is every species has a right not to be exterminated, not to go extinct by our hand.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, nature is a lot of different things. It's a very beautiful, beautiful thing that we all appreciate, but it can be also very, very cruel, and it can change, has cycles. And while everything deserves a chance to live, we're all part of this flux. That's what nature is. And what's important is that we don't try to make it different because of what we selfishly want for ourselves.
Well, yeah, I mean, the fact that that human beings at this point have the ability to have the impact on the earth that an ice age has is pretty, is sort of overwhelming.
It is. It's frightening, and that's kind of a monster that's raising its head that we have never been aware of before.
Yeah, the monster being us.
Us. Right. And so that's why I say conservation is a product. I mean, that's not a very cool way to look at it, but it's actually a function that needs, you know, pristine nature does not exist anymore. It is gone.
Yeah.
We are here. We're not going to leave. We're not going to stop building roads. And so if we're here and we have nature that has to coexist with us, well, then we're going to have to figure out how to manage it. And that's what's different now. And we're seeing that we've done a lot of things that have been done in a very self-serving way. And now we have to figure out, okay, how can we live in harmony? I mean, that's why I say ranchers. You know, we have a lot to learn. There's a lot of new ideas, a lot of science. There's a lot of other people who are coming into the business of managing land. We all have to work together. And I think we have to live on the land in order to manage it, though. We can't manage it from Atlanta or from Boulder, from an office building.
Right.
We have to be out there.
Well, and I mean, as you've said a number of different times when I've heard you speaking about this subject, conservation is all about people, and the number of different people and different kinds of people and different roles that they have in conservation is really diverse. Some of them are scientists. They're working in laboratories. Some of them are working on the field. Some are working in bureaucracies in Washington. Some of them are you and your staff.
Mm-hmm. It's a very, very wide group of people, and working with people can be so challenging, but it can be also the most rewarding thing. You know, I think that one of the things Alan Savory has always he brought to this conversation is the first thing we have to do is create a set of rules. And a set of rules really is, what do we want together? It's not what we don't want. And if we can agree on what do we want from an environmental standpoint, what do we want from an ecological standpoint, what do we want from a lifestyle standpoint, which basically covers all the... Well, then we can go about and do the work.
So when you took over management of this ranch here, did you make that list? Like, what do we want? What was on it?
Well, it's a very predictable kind of things. We want native species. We want an ecosystem that is functioning by itself. We want water we can go out and drink. We want the wildlife to be able to live their life as they always have lived it. We want the land to be covered with native in a diversified plant community. So environmentally, we drew a picture of what we're going to look like in 50 years. You know, the corridors, water, and the uplands, and the wildlife. And so we actually draw pictures. And then from a economic standpoint, we want to make our living from managing cattle, from hunting, from inviting people to come to our ranches, to putting concerts on, to do all these things we're doing. Not how much money or whatever, but these are the things we want to do. And then from a lifestyle standpoint, we want our children to go to good schools. We want to be able to take a vacation every year. We don't want to work too hard. And by that, I mean we want to be able to take a vacation once in a while. So very normal kind of stuff, but you take time to sit down and write that down, not only with your family, but the people who live and work with you, with your neighbors, with the agencies that you work with, the Division of Wildlife agencies, or whoever it is, Nature Conservancy. And so you collectively say, these are the things we want, and then you go out and do it. Then you come back and you say, okay, are we doing these things?
And so you kind of check in and review your list?
Monitor and replan.
Yeah. We're talking to rancher Duke Phillips. What was the land like when you got here? I mean, was it pretty compromised by the hand of man, so to speak?
You know, I'm not sure if I have been able to see any really big difference. You know, everything in the natural world happens so suddenly, unless it's a, you know, catastrophic kind of thing, but day after day, week after week, month, year after year after year, it takes a long time for change to happen. I mean, change happens gradually. It doesn't jump up and all of a sudden you're in a different strata all of a sudden, unless you're in the bottom of a creek or in the jungle or in the eastern side of the United States where you have a lot of water.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, we're here in a sandy environment. We're adjacent to the Great Sand Dunes National Park.
5 inches of rainfall annually.
Yeah.
I mean, that's very dry.
Another piece that you have talked about and that a lot of people are talking about is the split between not so much, you know, red state, blue state, Democrat, Republican, but urban and rural. And I wondered how you saw that division and if you see people coming together across those divides. Like, what does that divide look like in the first place?
Well, I think I was talking earlier about all the kids that we have to come out, over 2,000 kids, and then we have people from all over the world coming to our guest operation. We have moms and dads, and we have seminars. So we have a lot, because we're 45 minutes, this is on the other property we have on the Front Range by Colorado Springs. Because we live in close proximity and we have an open gate policy, we have a lot of interaction with people from town who are coming out into nature. And we've seen over and over again how the 98% of people, or the people from town, are moving away from nature. And it's not because they intend to. It's just because of the lifestyle that we live in towns. And if we're going to do anything about the environmental woes that we have, if we're going to be able to preserve the traditions and the Western ranching heritage that we have as ranchers, we're very foolish to think we're just going to stand out here as 2% of the population and do it. It has to be something that's collaborative. And so everything that, a very big part of what we do with the concerts and the art and education programs, all these different things, is trying to get people together to talk about these things. It's like an alcoholic can't begin to cure themselves until they actually recognize they have the disease. You can't do anything about it until you actually know it. So you get together and you talk about it. And you talk about it in an unbiased kind of way, in an exchange, rather than me preaching to you or vice versa. And then you can go about figuring out how you're going to resolve this problem.
Do you find that your relationships with, I mean, I think it was about maybe 10, 15 years ago, there was sort of an all-time low of real antagonism, I think, between ranchers and conservationists. Do you see that that has improved?
Yeah, it's greatly improved, I think. I mean, one of the problems with conservation today is that we have to find a way to pay for it. And if you're going to have people living on the land, as we're going to, who are managing it, you need to pay those people. They have to have some kind of income. And there's going to have to be programs that are going to have to be supported by whoever, you know, is around, county, state, federal government, whoever it is, private. And so economics is a huge thing that has changed everything.
And so if you have land that needs to be conserved and it can be doing conservation and paying for itself, I mean, that's the model that you are trying to to put forward.
Well, I feel that very strongly that the model, there is a model that I think can be, can pay for conservation, that is having a cow herd. And so a cow herd on a piece of property supports the land, I mean, from a land ownership standpoint, taxes, insurance, all the different costs that you incur as a landowner can be paid for by that, and to have a vigorous conservation program. Cattle are not going to be, don't fool yourself if you're a rich guy thinking you're going to go buy a ranch and make a bunch of money off the cattle. No, the cattle will provide for the ownership cost and the conservation values. And then if you're going to make money, if that's what you want to do, well, then you're going to have to create a hunting program, a hospitality program, or some other kind of thing that you enjoy doing or something that the land has.
And so you've got multiple systems going on. You've got an ecosystem out on the land around you, whether it be 500 acres or 100,000 acres or whatever it is, and you have a kind of economically diverse economic system.
Mm-hmm. Right. You have to have an economic diversity, just like a healthy ecosystem has to be diverse. You have to have plants that can grow in hot weather, cold weather, rocky land, you know, bare land, whatever.
And you have to have an income stream that works during wet weather, dry weather, basically the same kind of thing.
Right.
Now, is your family or your children going into the family business?
Mm-hmm. I have four kids. My oldest daughter has been working with us, I think, almost 5 years. And I have my son, who's the next in age, who has been with us for 2 years. And I have a daughter who is working with handicapped kids, autistic, severely autistic kids. And I have a 17-year-old girl, my wife and I have always included them in all the decisions and, you know, what's happening on the ranch in the hope that they would come back, but they've always known that if they don't want to, that's cool too. So the door is always open, but if the, so anyway, I don't know if Julie and Grace will join us, but they say they will.
Now, you also have, an internship program where young people can come for 2 years?
We have two young people programs. One is an internship, which is more of a, they come and work for room and board, minimum of 6 months. And kids who are either traveling around the world, just got out of school, don't know what they want to do, summer vacations. So they're adventurers or whatever, and they just want to experience what it is to work on a ranch. We'll have maybe 15 to 25 of those a year.
And then they go on to do other things with their lives.
A lot of times they do, but a lot of times they stay and become an apprentice, which is someone who's on a career path to be a ranch manager, and that's a 2-year commitment. And it's basically a way of learning by trial and error. So we give them a herd of cattle, for example, and say, okay, these are yours. You're responsible for their grazing, monitoring for water, health, et cetera, as well as being involved in the rest of the ranch. And you're free to make mistakes as long as you don't make them more than once or too often. And off they go.
And meanwhile, you're providing them the training and they come to you for information.
Yeah, I mean, we guide them and provide support. We have incredible team of people who love young people who are inspired by managing land and trying to, you know, save the world by being ranchers. And it changes the whole culture. I mean, when people outside come to one of our functions, they go, where do all these amazing people come from and why are they here? And it's just because I think we're really open and genuinely want to share what it is that ranching means to us. And ranching is also very, very difficult to break into because it's so traditional. And most of the kids that come through our programs are not from ranching.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. I mean, these people who want to be ranch managers, mm-hmm. they come and study that for 2 years. What are their backgrounds?
Well, they come from all over, rarely from a ranch. We have had kids from ranches, obviously, too, but they have, ranch kids have a lot of opportunities to go to work on ranches. So it just so happened that the word has gotten out that we're a place where young people can go and be included. And we have a huge interest. We have waiting lists and, we get calls to, multiple calls a day sometimes.
Now, what do those young people go on to do after the 2 years?
Well, the apprentices manage the interns. They hire them, they fire them, they manage them every day. So that gives them, human resource experience. How do you manage people? How do you fire people? How do you, handle all those kinds of things? And they go on to be ranch managers, either for us managing a ranch. We also have a ranch management service for ranch owners, so these have been cultivated to go out onto ranches that they would manage, and then the interns, they go back to school or they go back home,
So there's a whole new crop of ranch managers mm-hmm. in the country who come from all kinds of different backgrounds and are presumably bringing whatever their ideas and culture are to this traditional culture.
Right. Yeah, exactly. It's going to make it even richer.
Well, very interesting. It's just about time to go. Is there any last thing you want to let us know or let our listeners know?
Oh, man. I just appreciate the opportunity to talk about what we do. I mean, I love what I do, and to be able to talk about it and share it is really cool.
Duke Phillips is CEO of Ranchlands. He's the manager of the Nature Conservancy Medano Zapata Ranch in southern Colorado near Alamosa.
He's on the board of the Western Landowners Alliance.
And you can find out more at ranchlands.com. There's also an online journal, Ranchlands Review.
The Western Landowners Alliance is on the web at westernlandownersalliance.org.
Duke Phillips, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
It's great to be here. Thank you.